So after thanking everyone for joining us, and please come forward if you can and sit a little bit closer. These are the handouts that we put here so that people could sit here on this side. I'm going to ask you the following question, and we'll see if we can evoke an answer from the tzibur, from the people who are here. And I want to thank you for coming to the shiur. My question is the following. The topic for our discussion today, you may have seen it in the announcement, is contemporary geirus, conversion in our time. And here's the question that I want to ask you. A woman comes for geirus. She was married to a non-Jewish man, and the two of them come for conversion. And conversion has to take place in the presence of a beitin, of a court. And the court asked her, in this case, whether or not she is committed to observe the mitzvot of the Torah. And her response was yes. And they converted her. They sent her to the mikvah. She did what she had to do. And listen to the end of the story. After she and her husband had undergone conversion, they get married. Because a couple that's non-Jewish that converts have to get married again, which is called chuppah v'kiddushin. So they get married on a Friday afternoon, and they celebrate their marriage, seuda, you know, the how would you say seuda in English?
A meal.
This, you know, the hoopla, the fun, in a place that's not kosher. The food is treif, and not only that, the dancing, the singing, and the music went on Shabbat. This is 1 week to the day after the conversion in the Beit Din. Okay, what would you say? I'm trying to see if you can give me your gut feeling. What would you say about such a conversion? Anybody? Wait, before you give me the answer. Okay.
Not valid.
Not valid. Why not? Well, what is the fact that a week later they got married? Why does that invalidate the conversion?
Because they don't keep their mitzvot.
Right. Excellent. Okay. That's a very... does everybody agree with that? Anybody else want to say anything? Why? Take another opinion? Is there another possibility that maybe we should validate this conversion? Yeah?
I don't know. But I imagine that much depends on the intention at the time of conversion.
Right.
Because otherwise, why would a Jew who doesn't keep mitzvahs?
Who can answer that question? Why is it that a Jew who violates the Shabbos would still be a Jew, whereas in this case, perhaps, Iglai Milslam Afreya, how we retroactively understand that there was no serious, genuine commitment to the mitzvahs? Anybody? How long did it take until the marriage ceremony took place? Do you remember the facts of the case?
Friday afternoon.
But how long since the geirus?
1 week.
1 week. Okay.
So maybe that invalidates the
intention.
Wait, speak again.
No, that was the reason for the geirus. That he or she, I didn't hear the beginning of it.
Right.
He or she wanted to marry somebody, so
right. Go ahead, please.
Can we assume they know this?
Just speak a drop loud if you don't mind.
Can we assume that they know the halachas about Shabbos and so forth?
So I think the answer to that question is it depends where on the face of the earth you are. Here in the state of Israel, in order to apply for conversion, you have to undergo a very intensive course that could last anywhere between 6 to 12 months. In New York, for example, the Rabbinical Council of America will, on an average year, convert 100 gerim. But there are many more hundreds that were part of the original program of the what you call the Ulpan for Gerus. Most of them drop out. Why do you think they drop out? Why is the dropout rate so high?
It's difficult.
Correct. They realize, hey, this is not what I bargained for. What? Shvetz is out of Yid. Yeah, it's very hard to be Jewish.
Well, I can imagine extenuating circumstances. Number one, they don't realize it's too straight. They're led to believe it's kosher. Number two, they get married for Shkia, and it's not their intention, but maybe they are pressed to stay on for this Yehuda.
Okay, so maybe there was no... What is your first name? I'm sorry?
David.
David is saying, and tell me if I'm formulating what you're saying correctly and accurately, there was no intention, there was no deliberate intention on their part to violate the law. Or maybe we shouldn't go that far, maybe we should say it's a suffix. We don't have clarity here, but there's certainly room to doubt. Maybe, perhaps, in this case, they didn't realize that, you know, there would be some Chil Shabbos at the wedding. Again, it's a little bit far-fetched because they got married right before they knew who... In fact, they may have hired the band.
You have a problem if you said it was invalidated, because what about the people you don't know about? So how does the invalidation come about? Is it when you know about it and you say you're no longer Jewish? Or is it when you do it and you become not Jewish? In that case, if you don't know about it, you've got a lot of non-Jewish people.
So what would be the answer to your question? In other words, these people show up in a Beit Din, in a Jewish court, and they say they want conversion. What should be the protocol for the rabbis who are sitting in on this court to avoid a situation like this one? That's right, there has to be clarity here in something as crucial as Shabbos or Kashrus, that they understand what they're getting into. Now, again, you could always ask me, maybe that's too burdensome, you know, can we actually go through the whole list of 613 mitzvahs with them one by one? But that's why we have what's called an Ulpan L'Geirut. You know, there's a whole... Now, even a non-religious Jew here in Israel realizes there's something called Shabbat. You know, it's very hard to imagine that the person wouldn't realize that you're not allowed to eat non-kosher food. But let me ask you a second question, okay? Who's willing to address this question? This came up in the Beis Din just a while ago. A very recent case. A man studied for conversion. He comes in front of the courts. And when they ask him, is he committed to the mitzvot? He says yes. The entire court and all the judges unanimously are impressed by his sincerity. And so, they megayer him. He undergoes conversion. That means mila and tvila. He has a bris mila. He goes to the mikvah. And this is all supervised by the Beis Din. Are you with me so far? Everything looks hunky-dory, as we say. You know, kosher v'yosher. And here's the end of the story. 2 years after the Gerus, he's interviewed by an Israeli newspaper, and he tells them, point number one, that he is linked up to a partner. He has a partner in life. The only problem is his partner is male. Wait a minute. We're not finished yet. The man is living in a homosexual relationship, and let's go a step further. When they asked him in this interview, how then do you convince the rabbis to convert you? And he says the following, listen to his response. He says that it could be, as far as the rabbis are concerned, I'm not a convert. Because I was living in this homosexual relationship for years before the conversion. But as far as I'm concerned, I am a convert. What would you say about this case? Anybody? I'm looking for someone who's willing to tell me what you would say about this case.
I'd say he's converted because he wanted to be converted.
But let me ask you a question. When you say he wanted to be converted, there are three critical elements to Gerus. One is Mila in the case of a male. Two is Tefillah, Mikvah, both in the case of a male and a female. And number three is what we call Kabbalat Mitzvot. He has to accept upon himself the mitzvot. Well, he, by his own admission, at least with regard to one very serious violation, he did not accept the Torah. He himself admits that he fooled the Beit Din. Now, does anybody know a little bit about the broader range of halakha, the broader scope? I'm going beyond the narrow, restricted area that we're studying today of Geirut. Where do we have a halakha that tells me that if you were duped, if you were misled, then your actions are legally invalid? Okay, here's the case I want to discuss with you. Let's say I order a certain volume of wheat, and we sign a contract, and I agree to pay you X. And guess what? Instead of delivering wheat, what do you deliver to me? Barley. Now, some people love barley, okay? I think some of the dietitians are claiming that barley is a very healthy thing to eat. But he ordered wheat. This is what's called, in the language of the Shas, Mekach Ta'ut. So again, if I could write this on the whiteboard here, the main concept here is Ta'ut. Ta'ut means a halachic entity or a halachic agreement that was predicated on misinformation. Again, we always have to ask ourselves, well, how much of a discrepancy is there between what he ordered and what was delivered? Meaning, let's say he ordered a kor chitim, a certain volume, and instead he got less than a kor. Maybe it was one-tenth less than a kor. He only got 90% of what he ordered. So it could be that in that case, it's not a ta'ut. He can get back the overcharge, the differential. But if it was chitin and sa'orin, which are two different categories of food, he ordered one and they delivered the other, that's called ta'ut. That is a mistake. And here's the question that I want to raise with you. Supposing the potential ger fools the Beit Din, and he has them convinced that he is an absolutely genuine, sincere convert. He wants to accept the whole gamut of halakha. And then he admits to you later that he was living in this relationship and he fooled the Beit Din. Can we apply the principle here of ta'ut, that the action of the Beit Din was predicated on a mistaken premise, and now when they find out that this was a mistake, we should invalidate the action of the Beit Din? Yes. I'm just going to move this around. I don't know how to do this, but anyway. Does anybody... Okay, fine. I'm just going to leave it here. Does anybody want to make a comment? Would you, in this case, tell me that although in the first case, the woman went ahead and she got married in a very questionable kind of way with a Chil Shabbos and a kashrus issue, but in this case, as opposed to the first case, it wasn't that Beit Din is still wavering back and forth, did this lady mislead us or did she not? Maybe, as you said before, David, she expected to do X and that was good enough for her to become Jewish. But what about a person who by his own confession tells you that he misled the Beit Din? Anybody?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I wanted to compare it to something that I think applies to most of the people in this room.
If it applies to most of the people in the room, then you're going to have to raise your voice because we're competing here. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's air conditioning. I'm not sure.
It's air conditioning. Okay. I think the majority of people in this room have driving licenses. And I also think the majority of people in this room exceed the speed limit not once a year, but maybe more.
Okay, I'm not going to admit, I don't want to confess my sins publicly here. They may come with the police and lock me up. But let's say I grant you that, we're all guilty of some vehicle driving violations. Does that mean that we should forfeit our licenses?
That's what I'm saying.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So I'm not sure about the analogy because I don't see that it is analogous. But I do think that the because the intention at the time was to mislead, that they would be entitled to
nullify?
Right,
levatel, or in English, to nullify. I'm using those terms, you know, interchangeably.
Please. Different from the woman, because she may or may not have intended to keep Shabbos and do the rest, and then decided not to. He fully intended to.
Excellent. Excellent. What do you say?
This leads to the definition of what exactly is a mechatol.
Right.
What's a mechatol? What is considered a mistake, and what is considered deliberate?
But are you willing to grant that if a person comes for conversion and is not interested in a cardinal sin, you know what I mean by a cardinal sin, and he deliberately denies that information by his own confession to the judges, would that fulfill this requirement of ta'ut?
No.
Why not?
Because he did it on purpose. He purposely hid the information.
That's what I call fraudulent. I think we're both saying the same thing.
That's not a ta'ut. That's not a mistake.
No. I'm sorry. Ta'ut, I'm talking about the judges. In other words, I'm not going to tell you. Again, he is very proud of the fact that he converted. He is boasting about the fact that he fooled the Beit Din, and from his perspective, that's what conversion is, minus a cardinal sin. That doesn't bother him in one bit. But I'm asking if the action of the Beit Din is valid legally when they were in a state of ta'ut, when they were fraudulently, duped, and they didn't realize that this man is in a relationship which is, as I said, a cardinal sin. Again, this is not the place to discuss homosexuality. This is not, today there's a whole issue in contemporary life, how we treat, homosexuals. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that whether we like it or not, it's a cardinal sin. And therefore, he's omitting from his gerus in Kabbalah's mitzvahs a major chunk. But he's very proud of the fact that he fooled the Beit Din. And he omitted that information, which only came out later when it was published in a newspaper. David?
What exactly do you mean by a cardinal sin?
In other words, the chiv misas bezdin. In other words, it's... I don't know, maybe is my English a little off here? Maybe it's not called the cardinal sin? I tell you what, just for our purposes, would it be clearer to you if I called it a capital crime? Okay, I think it's also a cardinal sin, but...
As opposed to one of the sins for which you must give up your life rather than commit.
In this case, you'd also have to give up your life. He's a rodef. If a man is running after another man in order to rape that man, he would be considered a rodef if we put him to death. But again, that's not for us. That's a different discussion. Our discussion here is on gerus. Okay. So then, let me see if I could go on here. I don't know how to work this thing. Yeah, if you know how to do this? Okay, fine. Okay, let me go on to the next point. Okay. Here's what I want to ask you. There's a concept in law, whether it's halakha or secular law, called clarification, which means that we need a mode or a method by which we can clarify the facts on the ground. Can any of you think of a classic method of clarifying reality according to halakha? Something even more fundamental than cross-examination. Maybe cross-examination will be the next step, but the first step, what do we need? I come to a court, for example, and I say you owe me $1,000, right? How does Beit Din, how would the court clarify that indeed you owe me $1,000, that my claim is a true claim? I heard the word, I think, but if somebody could say it, drop louder. Edim, excellent. We have witnesses. The Torah says the following, Al Pishnayim Edim Yakum Dover. In other words, Yakum Dover means we want to clarify the reality, and the Torah says that reality is going to be clarified by the two witnesses. Now, we have to figure out who qualifies legally as witnesses, and that's a very complicated issue. But one thing I could tell you, if we can disprove the clarification of the witnesses. In other words, if we can be absolutely certain that in their attempt to clarify, they fabricated the truth. This is called, in the language of Shas, called Baharug Baraglov. I'll just write it down here in case anybody wants to. This is a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Baharug Baraglov, which means that the witnesses testified that Shimon was murdered. The only problem is that Shimon is alive and well, and he walks into the court. So in that case, we know beyond the shadow of a doubt that these witnesses cannot clarify the reality. They could fabricate the reality and lie, but that's not reality. Okay. Now here's my next question. Given the fact that my paradigm of clarification would be, in a Torah context, two witnesses, what now is the role, according to Jewish law, of a Beit Din, of a court? Is it identical with that of two witnesses?
Those two witnesses?
No. I'm asking the following. When we discuss the authority of a Beit Din in the process in which they hand down a ruling, is that process clarification? Or is there perhaps another additional element in the equation here? Anybody?
I don't understand the question.
I'm asking the following. When a Beit Din hands down a ruling, a verdict, is that simply clarification? Meaning, they, like the witnesses, investigate, they take all the evidence, they weigh it, they come to a conclusion, and basically the purpose and the agenda of Beit Din is just to clarify. Did Reuven actually borrow $1,000 from Shimon? Well, we need some sort of an objective, experienced body of judges to clarify exactly what happened. And based on the facts on the ground, they will issue a decision. And basically, in this definition, the authority of Beit Din, it doesn't go beyond clarification.
It's not the facts on the ground. It's the evidence they've been given.
Okay, but that's what I'm asking. Is it just simply what did I do here? All right. Is it just simply that the role of Beit Din is to clarify the reality? And once they do so, the answer or the ruling, the verdict, is going to be crystal clear.
Beit Din is basically concerned with the procedure for clarification. Witnesses are the ones who actually do the clarification.
Correct, I understand, but I'm saying, is there any element beyond that? Okay, let me ask you the following question. This is a Mishnah in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, and the Mishnah says that the Beit Din will determine the Chodesh. Today is Rosh Chodesh, and they will declare that today is Rosh Chodesh.
So they need Eidim,
correct? So the witnesses come, they testify they saw the moon, and the Beit Din issued what's called a declaration. It's called, again, in the language of the Mishnah, it's not important for us today, Mekudosh, Mekudosh, Mekudosh. The new month is sanctified. The Gemara goes on to say that what happens if the Beit Din made a big mistake? That's what we called Tos. And guess what? The Gemara says that once they declare that the month is Mekudosh, that declaration is valid despite the fact that they made a mistake. Here's another case. A monetary case, and the Gemara addresses this, that came up in front of a court. Now, a Beit Din for monetary cases requires how many judges? Three judges. And guess what? The judges made a mistake. So the Gemara says the following. If they contradicted what we call an open and shut Mishnah, then it's batel, it's invalid. Their decision is invalid. But if they made a mistake in judgment, for example, they thought that the halakha was like Beit Shammai instead of Beit Hillel, for example, even though the tradition is that we paskin like Beit Hillel, then the decision and the verdict is binding, it is irreversible, and then after Shimon, as a result of this decision, pays up Reuven, where the judge has made a mistake, Shimon has recourse to sue the judges for damages because they made a big mistake. What I'm suggesting to you is that despite the fact that the judge has made a mistake, the decision is valid. That goes way beyond clarification. If they're only there to clarify and they made a mistake in their clarification, then obviously the decision is not binding. And here, the Gemara says that even though they made a mistake, which is called a toz, and that's the lashon of the Gemara, Now again, you might ask the following question. Well, if the decision handed down by the court is binding and it's irreversible, why doesn't that apply even if they contradict the Mishnah? So we have to now add a little bit of an adjective to describe the mistake. What kind of mistake did they make? A reasonable mistake. Do you follow me? There's certain mistakes that are unreasonable. You know, if the judges were unaware of a pasuk, a verse in Chumash, that would not be a reasonable mistake. But as long as we're within the context of a reasonable mistake, then their decision is valid. Even though they admit that they made a boo-boo, they made a mistake. Had they known X, they would never have handed down that verdict. And they forced Shimon to pay $1,000 to Reuven based on a mistake. Based on the fact that they thought, you know, judging the case, it would seem to us that the halakha should be so and so. And they decided that, you know, the logic of Beit Shammai is very compelling. But in fact, the halakha has accepted Beit Hillel. I'm just giving names for an example. It's not important, the details. What I'm trying to show you is that the concept of ta'ut with regard to Beit Din, in a case, again, of a reasonable mistake, is not identical with the classic universal concept in Jewish law of ta'ut, meaning the implications of a mistake in the case of Beit Din, is not identical with the mistake that was made in, let's say, a buyer-seller situation. In a buyer-seller situation, everything depends upon what's called das. Das means the mindset of the buyer and the seller. If there was a mistake, if there was a major toz of significance in the essential kinyan, in the essential transaction, that becomes a chisaron, a lack of das. You know, I thought I had das, but in truth I didn't have das. In the case of Beit Din, however, Beit Din is not just a decision made in dat, but is a decision that's made with the Gishpanka, I don't know how to say that. Who could help me translate that to English? With the authority, okay, we'll call it the authority of a Beit Din. This is what we call a Masa Beit Din. Now, what about Gerus? What about conversion? Does anybody know what would be the law if a non-Jew would convert what we call Beino Levein Atzmo, just in the privacy of, he would, let's say, get together two witnesses just to make sure that he could clarify this, and he jumps into a mikvah, he has a moel do his mila for him, would that gerus be valid?
Yes. No.
Not at all. Because the Gemara says that in two places in the Torah, the word ger is mentioned, and that you'll find on page 1 of the handout that I gave you. And in that same context, it says mishpat. Mishpat is a Beit Din. And the gerus, the conversion, has to take place in the presence of and under the supervision of a Beit Din. Now my question to you is, the Beit Din has to be convinced that this misgayer, this potential convert, is absolutely sincere about accepting the mitzvot, because that's one of the essential parts of gerus. Well, guess what? The Beit Din was fooled. They were, what word can I use? Duped. I don't know, that's maybe an American word. But anyway, they, maybe it's a British word, I don't know. But anyway, they were fooled. Correct? And this ger was anything but sincere about his gerus. So you and I would say, well, in such a case, Beit Din made a ta'ut. But now we're saying that the role and the authority of Beit Din, as a general principle, is not clarification. It goes way beyond clarification. And even in cases of ta'ut, the decision of Beit Din is called a ma'isa Beit Din, and it is valid. It has a certain legal status to it. They can decide that today is Rosh Chodesh when today is really not Rosh Chodesh. And simply because they handed out that decision, given all the mistakes that they made, it is Rosh Chodesh. In other words, we're not talking about clarifying, we're talking about declaring, we're talking about creating, we're talking about changing the legal status of something simply because of a Maisa Beit Din. So now I have to ask you the following question. In the case of Gerus, even if I grant you that the Ger somehow, in some way or another, was able to mislead the Dayanim, the judges sitting on the court, and they mistakenly thought that he was sincere and he was motivated because he really wanted to embrace the entire gamut of Jewish law. Nevertheless, it's a Maisa Beit Din. Could we argue that since the Gemara says there's no such thing as Gerus in the privacy of my own room, but Gerus has to take place publicly in front of a court, and it's the Dayanim who will declare that this person is in fact a Ger, what the Dayanim are doing is they're taking a non-Jew and making him into a Jew. They are creating a new reality in a halachic legal universe. They are not clarifying, but once they have, you know, reason to believe, again, if it's obvious that this fellow, then they're just playing games. I mean, that's not Ger. But if there's reasonable indication that the Ger made a statement and a declaration and he was sincere about it, and all the judges on the court unanimously came to the conclusion that this is a real Gerus, it's a real McCoy, a real sincere, then maybe what we could do here, again, who says this, what I'm about to tell you? My name is Berzon. I never got a chance to introduce myself. So Berzon says that in this case, the Gerus would be valid, despite the fact that the Dayana made a mistake, because it's no difference than a toast in Dini Mavanos, again, if it's a reasonable toast, which is valid and binding and irreversible, because of the halacha and the status of a Maisa Beit Din. Beit Din are creating something new. Does everybody follow me? This is the crucial point that I want to get across today. And I don't know if I'm right, but my theory is that Beit Din is not just clarifying. They're not just there, you know, clarifications for the witnesses. That's their exclusive job. Their contribution is to clarify what they saw, and they'll be investigated, interrogated, and so forth and so on. Beit Din is something totally different. Beit Din creates new reality in halacha. And in the case of Gerus, when the Torah says you require mishpat and a Beit Din, the Torah is actually authorizing the court to create Gerut. And I want to call to your... Yeah, go ahead, please. Yeah, I don't know if this is working or not working.
Does that mean then that once the Beit Din has declared this person a declared a Jew, then his status is like that of any Tom, Dick, and Harry, so to speak.
Right. I hope it's not Tom, Dick, and Harry, but called Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Right. Okay. Correct. Now, if the conversion is valid, what happens to a convert who goes ahead and, heaven forbid, violates the Shabbos? Well, guess what? He's chayav because of a Jew who violated the Shabbos.
Just clarify for me, then. What's the difference then between
Oh. So now we have to ask the question, what are the qualifications for a Beit Din? Oh, so that's my next question. How are we doing on the clock? We still have some time? Okay, you'll tell me when you have to leave. Because I can go on and on. This is such a complicated and exciting topic. The word mishpat, which is the source for the requirement of a Beit Din in the case of Gerus, means what we call mumchim, okay?
Experts.
Right. Mumchim literally is translated as experts. But in this context, it means a heck of a lot more than just experts. The word mumchim in the Gemara and Sanhedrin throughout is synonymous with what we call smuchim, okay? Now, is there anyone here in this room who has smicha? Just by show of hands. Don't all answer at once. Okay. So if I was sitting where you're sitting, I would raise my hand because I have smicha. It's a bluff. I don't have smicha. Because you know what smicha means? Does anybody know what smicha means?
Put your hands on it.
Okay, everybody would agree with what you're saying, that smicha means in order to be ordained, you have to take a course of study, you'll be examined. You know, when I took my smicha exams, it was all in writing. There were written exams. When my father, may rest in peace, when he took his exams, it was an oral exam. Now, I don't know if you'll agree with me on this point, but I think I'd much rather take a written exam than an oral exam. Because in a written exam, you have time to think. And not only that, if you have enough ink in your pen, you could really fluff it up, if you know what I mean. But in the case of an oral exam, I don't know if you know this, there are, I think, 750 Israelis who are studying medicine in Budapest. And everybody gets accepted. And of course, you have to pay the fees, right? You have to pay tuition. There's only one problem, getting out, meaning getting a medical degree. For that, you have to take oral exams. And when you take an oral exam, if you hesitate for 1 minute, they fail you. So oral exams are much tougher. My father had to take an oral exam. It went on for hours and hours in front of three great scholars. And the rules for the game were they could ask you from anywhere. You know, not just about a drop of milk that fell into a pot of meat. Like, for example, my father said they asked him about Yal Kagam, which is six cases in Shas that we pass like a bite against rubber. I mean, he was really sweating it out. So now, what is smicha? I'm telling you that we don't have smicha. Because you know what smicha means? An unbroken chain that takes us all the way back to whom? Your favorite and mine? Moshe Rabbeinu. Ish mi pi ish. So Moshe Rabbeinu gave smicha to Yoshua and to the Zekanim, and it goes down and down until Ravina Ravashi at the closing of the Talmud. And at one point in Jewish history, it was broken. There was no longer smicha. 5 centuries ago in Tzfat, there were a group of rabbis who wanted to try to be Machadish smicha. And then they were met with such opposition, I can't tell you today, to tell you. But in any event, we don't have smuchim today. And the Gemara tells us that a beitin for conversion is the same beitin that we need for monetary law. So for monetary law, we need a beitin of mumchim, which means smuchim. So I have two questions. I really want. How do we judge in front of a rabbinic court today monetary cases? Where are the mumchim? We don't have mumchim because we don't have smicha. Question number two. How can we convert non-Jews to Judaism when we don't have a beitin? And a beitin means it's got to be made up of smuchim. Can anyone figure out an answer to that question? I mean, this question boggles the mind of none other than the Gemara itself. The Gemara can't figure out. How do we accept Gerim today when we don't have mumchim? So to answer this question, the Gemara introduces a brand new concept. And that's called Shlichusayu Ka'avdinon. Okay? The emphasis here is on the word Shlichut. Who can translate that word for me? Anybody? Shlichut, a Shaliach. What's a Shaliach?
Messenger.
Correct, a messenger, an agent, an emissary. We have, what's it called? A notary, you know, somebody who is given power and recognized. So, what the Gemara says is that our courts are halachically valid and their decisions are binding because they are shluchim. They are the emissaries of the original batei dinim, the courts that were musmachim, that had smicha. In other words, what the Gemara claims is that we have to go back into a time machine, I don't know, maybe 18 centuries ago or 16 centuries ago, I don't know exactly how long, and when there was a beitin of mumchim, and they knew that at some point in the future there's going to be a termination of smicha, they already anticipated that breakdown of the unbroken tradition. So what they did is they appointed any beitin that qualifies Again, qualification is again a very ambiguous term, but if the Beit Din is qualified, they are our shluchim. They will represent us. They're our long arms, so to speak, our emissaries to institute a verdict, to take a decision and declare that decision as valid. But the Gemara has a problem. Yeah, please.
So, I established the qualifications which would enable someone to act as their Shalea, even though they never personally appointed him.
Excellent question. I don't know how to answer your question. What's the mechanics of shlichus? See, I mean, they didn't know that, you know, 18 centuries down the line, you know, Yankel Beryl is going to sit on a Beit Din. I mean, did they appoint Yankel Beryl 1800 years ago as their shliach? So I'll get back to that point in just a minute. But here's the question I want to ask you. I don't know how many people here in the room have ever heard of something called Takonas Argentina. These are the Sephardic Jews in Argentina, and it spread through many different areas in the Sephardic community, including Syria. You know what they call Aram Tsova, the Chalabim, if you're familiar. They made a takana that there should be no gerus. They basically outlawed conversion. I don't know if you know about this. My brother-in-law, may rest in peace, was a rabbi in a Sephardic shul. His name was Greenwald, so you can imagine how Sephardic he was. But they forced him in that shul to sign this excommunication that you're not allowed to have gerus today. Again, if I had an hour, I would tell you why they instituted this enactment. But it was an Isur Chamor. And about 100 years ago, a case came up where a group of three rabbis converted someone in these Sephardic countries where they'd accepted this prohibition. And the question is whether that gerus is valid. We have something called lechatchila and bidyevet. Lechatchila means ideally, and then bidyevet means post facto. So ideally they shouldn't have done what they did. They violated this terrible Isur Cherem, and they were megayer someone. Now what do we do with the gerus? Are these people Jewish? Do we say that the Beit Din violated their jurisdiction, so to speak, because they were in violation of this cherem, and therefore the whole deal is off? Or do we say no? B'dieved, we have to recognize this gerus. So this came up a century ago. I don't know if you knew of the chief rabbi, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi here in Israel, even in Palestine. His name was Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. And he came to the following conclusion. The gerus is invalid. Why? Because in shlichus, we have a principle called ein shliach l'dvar avera. I cannot serve as your representative to violate the halacha. So that even if I grant you that the original Beit Din of Mumchim way back when appointed our Batei Dinim as Shluchim as their representatives, but that's only for the sake of a mitzvah, not for the sake of an Avera. And since these judges had violated their jurisdiction rights and implemented this gerus, the gerus is invalid because we can no longer activate the principle of what? Shlichu Sayukov Dinan. Is there anybody here in this room who understands what I'm saying? I don't know. Nobody's responding. I'm getting nervous here. If you understood what I said, please raise your hand. Oh, okay. Well, at least we have a Zimun. Let me try it once again. If our authority today to institute gerus is predicated on shlichus, because our batei dinim, our courts are representatives through the agency rule of shlichus to be megayer gerim, and that's what gerus is in our time, because we don't have a beit in a mumchin, then according to Rav Frank, we should activate the principle called ein shliach l'dvar avera, which means that shlichus can never operate in a case of an avera, in a case of a violation of Jewish law. Since these rabbis had violated Jewish law, therefore their gerus is invalid. Now, how many people in this room have ever heard of Rav Sternbach? Okay, a few people heard of him. Rav Sternbach, who's a neighbor of mine in Har Nof, he came to the conclusion that if a Beit Din would get together And they would know full well that these potential gerim are not at all sincere about their gerus, then that is an avera. For them to institute conversion is a violation of Jewish law, hence there's no shlichus. And they cannot serve as mishpat, because mishpat requires mumchim, and our mumchim don't exist today except unless we apply the principle of shlichus. Comes along a contemporary of Rav Frank. His name was Rav Chai Uziel. He was the Sephardic chief rabbi at that time. And he disagrees with Rav Frank. And he comes to the conclusion that despite the fact that these three rabbis on the Beit Din had violated this enactment of the Sephardic community to outlaw Gerus, nevertheless, b'dieved, post facto, they shouldn't have done it, but that Gerus is valid. And this may surprise you, but Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a Tshuva Igros Moshe, without quoting Rav Uziel, comes to a very similar conclusion. And the case that he had was a case where a person came for Gerus, and as it turns out, they were not sincere about the Gerus, and there was a Beit Din that went ahead and converted them. Why? So Rav Moshe tries to justify the decision of that court to convert that individual, and he says the reason why they converted is because of another principle, which is called Dvarim Sheva Lev Einom Dvarim. What that means is that law, Jewish law, depends upon a declaration and not upon what somebody has in their heart. Dvarim Shebelev, that which is in your heart is irrelevant. What we have to have is your word, your declaration. If this potential convert made a statement, a declaration that I will fulfill the Torah, even if that person didn't have the least interest in observing the law, we apply the principle of Dvarim Shebelev and Dvarim, and Halacha is determined by his declaration and not by what he has in his heart and his mind. Says Rav Moshe, the exception to this rule is what we call an Anan Sadi. Anan Sadi means if we have clear evidence that the person was not serious, then in that case, the whole deal is off. And therefore, Moshe says the following, listen carefully. If I would have been a member of that court, and knowing that that person was not sincere about their gerus, I would not have given my hand to participate in the gerus. I would have objected, because in this case, we have an Anan Sadi. We know from the facts of the case, I'll read to you the case if we get a chance, that the person was less than sincere. But he says, since the Beit Din went ahead, relying on the principle of Dvarim Shebelev, and therefore they relied on the declaration of the ger, the potential ger, who declared that I am absolutely committed to observe the Torah, then Dvarim Shebelev, lo avi dvarim, again, Rav Moshe would never accept that because he holds that we go based on the ansadi. There was clear-cut circumstantial evidence. I mean, this woman got married, wanted to be megayer because she wanted to marry a Jewish man, and get this, the Jewish man was not Orthodox. He wasn't an observant Jew. For sure she was going to live the same lifestyle as her husband-to-be, which in fact she did. And I don't know if you have any experience with gerus, but unfortunately, I say tragically, a lot of gerim marry irreligious Jews, you know, in both directions, male, female. It's just, it's heart-rending, you know, to see a person who went through the whole process of becoming Jewish and then they marry an irreligious Jew. In any event, in the case of Rav Moshe, he said that the Anan Sadi is clear. The evidence is clear. She had no intention of observing the law. But nevertheless, b'dieved, he says, post facto, since the Beit Din went ahead and they instituted a gerus, we have to recognize the gerus. In other words, Rav Moshe is not accepting the logic of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who claims that there's no shlichus hayukav dinon if the Beit Din did something that they shouldn't have done. And in this case, clearly, according to Rav Moshe, based on the Anan Sadi, they shouldn't have converted that person. But nevertheless, even though they violated the law, and they shouldn't have done so, post facto, the gerus is valid. David.
half an hour ago you asked the question.
It's not working.
Which the answer was. The clarification is done by Ada. So the facts come out through Ada. So when the rabbi is saying that he knows from circumstances.
Right, so that we'd have to go through the tshuva again. You know, I've
not been listening to Aiden, has he?
Right. A non-sadi means circumstantial evidence. It doesn't mean there were Aiden. Again, you know, in the case of Geirus, nowhere does the halacha require two witnesses to testify that this person will observe the mitzvahs. We can never testify on the future. We can only testify on the present. And in the present sense, this Geir is a potential Geir is declaring, "I am absolutely sincere,"
and. The rabbi, looking at the surrounding circumstances, is of the view that the person is being dishonest.
He knows that the person is just making a, you know, what I call lip service. You familiar with that phrase? He's giving lip service to Kabbalah's mitzvahs, but it's not sincere. And this, my friends, is an amazingly difficult contemporary issue in our life today, because there are courts who are willing to convert Jews carte blanche. Again, don't quote me on this. You know, I'm not, this is, as we say, Beiravon Mugbal, you know, limited liability on this case. But to en masse convert thousands and thousands, if not tens of thousands of Jews who came on Aliyah to live in this land and serve in the Israeli Defense Forces, and these Jews are not in any way committed to observe the mitzvahs. So I think Rav Moshe would say in such a case that lechatchila, if all things were ideal, then for sure we would not convert such people. That's not an issue for Rav Moshe. It's clear, and nobody denies it, that these people are not interested in any genuine way. All they want to do is be part of the Jewish people. They get what's called the Tudat Zehut. They're recognized under the law of return as Jews. They'll serve in the Israeli army. And what do you say about that? Go ahead.
Are you limiting what you're saying to Orthodox conversions? Is there a different scenario with the Reform?
I don't know anything about Reform conversion. You're asking the wrong person. A Reform conversion, again, don't quote me on this, is worthless. Worthless, because you don't have a Beit Din made up of Reform rabbis. Now, if you had Orthodox rabbis, I would assume it's not going to be a Reform conversion. So I don't know. I can't answer your question. I would be very hard pressed to imagine in my wildest dreams that three Orthodox rabbis would have a Reform conversion. Maybe there is such a thing, and I don't know about it. But I'm talking about three so-called Orthodox rabbis, which, again, according to Rav Sternbach, they lose and forfeit their status as Beit Din because they can't be shluchim to do a conversion that's illegal according to Jewish law. If things are crystal clear and nobody denies that these people are only converting for reasons X, Y, or Z, they have no interest in being sincerely observant to the mitzvahs HaTorah, they shouldn't be involved in such geiris. Comes along Rav Uziel, you know, in the case of the Cherim of the Argentina, comes along Rav Moshe in the case where he says that I have an Ansari, I would never have participated in such a Geirus. But you see, here's the difference. See, Rav Uziel he admits that the Beit Din really violated an Avera because of the Cherim. Rav Moshe is saying, well, maybe I could justify their decision based on Dvarim Shebelevein and Dvarim. But again, Dvarim Shevilevein and Dvarim, says Rav Moshe, would not apply in a case where it's obvious, but maybe that Beit Din, they relied on a declaration. Now, here's where I want to add one piece to the puzzle, and that's Maitza Beit Din. Do you remember this concept? It could be, and here's where the whole debate is going to come to a fore, it could be that Beit Din, even if they made a mistake, even if they were fooled, let's come back to our original cases where she went, you know, she went a week later to get married and violated the Shabbos Kashrus laws. Or the fellow who misled the Beit Din into thinking that he's living a normal sexual life, but really he wasn't. In these cases, one could argue that even though the Beit Din was duped, they made a mistake, and therefore would be a toast, had they been aware of the facts on the ground, they never would have converted this person. But nevertheless, Maisa Beit Din tells me that the Beit Din has a certain authority once they issue their Maisa Beit Din, and the halacha will recognize that post facto. And I think Rav Moshe Feinstein, in my humble opinion, is very much influenced by this logic, and therefore he says, look, I would never have sat on such a Beit Din, I would never have participated in that conversion, but you know what? let it go. Post facto, we're going to let it go. And this, my friends, has tremendous implications for probably thousands of converts in the state of Israel. I don't think I'm exaggerating. People who, if Rav Moshe would have been on the Beit Din or any of the other poskim that we mentioned earlier, they would not have agreed latet yad, you know, to participate and contribute to this Beit Din. But post facto, if the Gerus was already implemented, then as opposed to what we said in the name of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank or Rav Sternbach, the Gerus would be valid because we're not going to invalidate the Gerus. The question only is, what about Shlichus Sayukov Dinan and the principle of Ein Shliach L'Dvar Avir?
Does the Christian girl, let's say, get any slip of paper saying you're authorized to count yourself as a Jew today?
Sure, sure.
So
every ger walks out of the Beit Din with a document testifying with the signature of three judges that he or she is a ger or a gioris.
So can you now take me, a Christian girl, to court because I'm not doing this?
Again, the declaration itself and the process of Geirus is all oral. It's not legally binding. It's only halachically binding to allow the judges to convert. Once the judges went ahead and they converted her, she is a Geirus according to this school of thought. The other school of thought says, wait a minute, the judges had no right halachically to institute this Geirus. Had they done it lechatchila, would have been completely prohibited. There's no sincerity here. There's no indication that the person is doing anything but lip service, and therefore there's not shlichus. So you cannot recognize this as shlichus. Those are the people who want to say today that tons of conversions are absolutely invalid. As I said before, iglai milslav afreya, retroactively we have to invalidate and nullify those gerus. And then we have another school of thought, and those poskim would say, you know what, post facto, they shouldn't have done it, but they did it. We have to recognize that. This is the heaviest issue in modern-day conversion. Yes? Did I get too emotional? I apologize.
Once this was done, this is it. Isn't this similar to the people who declare today is Rosh Chodesh, but really...
Correct. Then we're applying the principle of Maisa Beit Din. But there's only one problem, and I can't solve this problem for you. In the case of Rosh Chodesh, we're talking about Mumchim. These people are clearly authorized to be Mekadesh the Chodesh. In fact, we're talking about the Sanhedrin Agdol of 71 judges.
But we are saying that they made a mistake, that it really tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh.
Correct. So what I'm saying is that the Maisa Beit Din of Mumchim is certainly recognized by the Torah. But today, that we don't have Mumchim, how do we get a Beis Din for Gerus? The whole institution of Gerus today, according to this school of thought, again, there are other opinions, is predicated on Shlichus Sayukov Dina, on the fact that the original Beit Din, that were Mekadesh the Chodesh, they authorized us as their emissaries, their representatives, to form a Beit Din, and in this case, to convert non-Jews. Well, are we making them happy? Do they have a smile on their face in the Olam HaEmes up there? And are we really serving as their shluchim? If your answer is no, that the shlichus is completely null and void because this is not what they had in mind, there's a tshuva from Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Palestine, from 100 years ago, in which he writes that someone came to him for gerus and he didn't want to do mila, no circumcision. So the rabbi asked him, why not? Mila is an integral part of circumcision. He says, the doctor's orders. Doctors told me at my age, it's too dangerous. So Rav Kook says that in this case, this is not Shlichus Sayukov Dina. When they back then appointed us as their shluchim, their representatives, what they meant was to have mila and tefila and Kabbalah mitzvahs. They didn't have in mind some sort of fluky case where the guy can't do mila. And then Rav Kook goes on to say, if we let this guy be Megayer tomorrow, you'll have a long line, what do they call in Britain, a queue, right? A queue of people who are waiting online to have Geirus without Mila. Because every one of them has a little doctor's note that's signed by a physician in Kupat Cholim that says that, you know, for me, Mila is very dangerous. This is Rav Kook a century ago who's anticipating the problems of Geirus. But he takes a clear-cut stand and he says that if a Beit Din would go ahead and be Megayer some without Mila based on a doctor's description, he said, that's not Geirus. That's not the Shlichus that Chazal had in mind. All right, I want to thank everyone for coming today. Obviously, we cannot come to any definite conclusion. These are very, very serious issues.
What a relief.
And I just have to tell you that it could be relevant to everyone sitting here, but I'll tell you why. Because if your daughter or your son wants to marry this kind of a Geirus situation, then you have to check it out. You may require another Geirus to replace the first Geirus if the second one is sincere and the first one was not. And that really depends upon how we understand Shlichus Hayuka of Dina. And David, you asked me before, how does the Beit Din, you know, 2,000 years ago, how did they appoint me as their Shliach? So I have in the pages that I gave you, there's a tshuva in Tchumin. I don't know if you ever heard of Tchumin, which is one of the great contemporary journals. And he says that the Shlichus Hayuka of Dina is not for every single case and every single Geirus, you know, that we have to see whether we are Shluchim and the Beit Din is representing them or not. But rather, there's a general Shlichus Hayuka of Dina. You know, it's an overall kind of appointment of all Batei Dinim. As long as the Batei Dinim are made up of Jews who know the halacha and they are implementing the law according to their best understanding, then we can apply Shlichus Hayuka of Dinim. He actually comes to the following conclusion, and we touched on it before, that in the first case of the girl, a week later gets married in a not such a kosher way, if you follow me, that Geirus is valid. But in the case of the homosexual, that's invalid. That for sure could not come under Shlichus Hayuka of Dina. Here for sure, the original Batei Dinim never appointed us as their representatives for this kind of a Geirus. The whole Geirus was predicated on a false assumption. It's a fabrication, and that would not be Geirus. In the first case, well, you know, the rabbis heard her say that she's sincere and she will observe the mitzvot. We don't know exactly what went on in the interim, and also, like you said before, maybe she didn't know about the Ka'ayla, whatever it is, you'll come up with some possibility. At least there's some possibility of margin of error so that we can assume that still we are shluchim of the original Beit. Okay then, I wish everyone a great day, and thank you so much.
And
Chodesh Tov, for sure. Yes. I didn't hear the last word in your sentence.
Argentina.
Right.
The subsequent Beit Din who did a conversion, the argument was that the conversion was invalid because it was contrary to Halakha.
That was for Frank.
Is it logical to come to that once the Kana has been made, unless it's got a
time limitation,
it can't be revealed?
That is true.
So now, Rabbi Gershon was talking about, he made it for 1,000 years or something, and basically it's been reinstated in perpetuity.
That I don't know. I don't have the answer to your question. I doubt it. I mean, unless you know otherwise, I would assume that it's what's called a minhag hamedina. It's no longer a cherem, because the cherem already expired, but now it becomes a minhag hamedina. And if the minhag hamedina changes, you know, if bigotry becomes acceptable, bigamy. Then maybe...
Bigamy,
I meant to say. No, I'm sorry, I meant to say bigamy.
Sorry.
Bigamy.
But I didn't mean to.
No, thank you so much.
That was off tape.